In today's episode of Private Stories, I speak with Lauren Windle, a recovered cocaine addict who started using cocaine during her time at university. Lauren became addicted after a toxic breakup at the age of 22, after which she decided she was going to become a party girl and used alcohol and cocaine to numb emotions such as loneliness and social anxiety. Lauren got clean at the age of 25 after she reached out to her sister and admitted she needed help. This began Lauren's recovery process. This is Lauren's story, where she discusses what she experienced and what her life looks like now. It's not a therapy session, however, it does cover the psychological impact of what Lauren experienced. Some people may find the content of this interview distressing.
I think I probably differ from a lot of like addiction stories that you can access online or that you hear, in that I didn't suffer any great trauma as a child. I grew up in a, like, as normal as sort of houses can be, with my parents and my sister, and I went to a school on our road and had friends and things like that. And there was nothing sort of note that was really difficult. But I guess in me, there were a few things that with hindsight I see were sort of red flags, and are things that I've heard other people in recovery talk about as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing to kind of highlight, you know, because often people will make assumptions that someone must have had some great trauma, or there must be some great explanation, and so many things can happen, people, very subtly and you know, early on in life, that just would not raise these alarm bells as to someone struggling in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I always just felt like I was on the outside. I never quite felt like accepted or popular, or like I was in the mix and in the middle of things. I always felt like I was like just striving, just fighting to get acceptance from people and the people around me. And that caused a lot of anxiety. And then as I got older, social anxiety, when I got places, I wanted to feel welcome, and I'd be really conscious of people who maybe hadn't come to greet me or weren't making conversation with me, and suddenly just felt like I shouldn't be there.
Yeah, which is so crippling. It's just an awful feeling to have to experience, and it's just so common that people end up experiencing social anxiety. It's we're social creatures, and it's to fit in is survival. So to feel socially anxious is such a common thing, but such a debilitating experience.
Yeah. And then when I got to maybe 13 when people started bringing alcohol out, and I was introduced to alcohol outside of like my home and things, and it was people were sort of drinking to get drunk. And I remember the first time that I started to get drunk, just thinking like, oh well, I don't feel tense anymore. I don't have that, you know, inside me. Like, and it's suddenly in my mind, I thought, well, I've got a solution then. I don't need to be so tense the whole time, because if I can just get something to drink, you know, whatever it was back then, like Bacardi Breezes. But then as I got older, maybe a glass of wine or a gin and tonic or whatever, two of those. And suddenly I just felt like I could breathe.
Alcohol is a very effective self-medicating strategy that really does work in the short term for social anxiety, and that's the problem. It works, but it's in the short term.
Yeah, and that's it. So I started to use alcohol like a crutch, and as you say, short term, that's totally fine. And you know, for that hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, that was fine. But when I got past the second drink and then was sort of a bottle down and then two bottles down, my behavior would become more erratic. And because I felt like I needed it, I felt like I relied on it, I didn't moderate my drinking very well. And obviously long term, that would have had quite a negative effect on my social life and socializing, because I became known as the person who got too drunk, who got out of control, who threw up, who made a real show of herself, who actually just wasn't that fun to have around, because I became hard work for my friends, people who had to look after me, and things like that. And I think because I grew up in London around teenagers, there was lots of drinking, there was lots of going to the park, and people would bring alcohol and people's older brothers and sisters would buy it for them.
Alcohol is just so accessible and so deeply ingrained in our cultures, like British and Irish culture, to drink and to, when you're young, it's very much about like going out and getting drunk, and that's just very acceptable.
Yeah, so I was hiding in plain sight. You know, like I was there acting in this way, but because lots of other people did it and because it was just, as you say, part of the culture, no one would have said to me, do you think you've got a problem with that? People yeah. just thought, I just hadn't worked it out yet. I just didn't know, you know, when to stop yet.
I think it's very uncommon for people to question young people's drinking behavior, because young people kind of, you know, have fun, act immature. It's sort of, whereas if an older person, if someone who's in their 40s is acting like that, people would ask them, you know, do you think you have a problem with drinking? But it's not really, I think you've made a really good point there. It's not really questioned when people are starting to show signs of problematic drinking behavior early on.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I continued like that, and I was drinking alcoholically from a young age. Without anyone really challenging me. And also, I just didn't have the money to do it all through the week. So it would be weekends and when I got a bit of extra cash that I would do it. So I couldn't sustain it just because, you know, I couldn't afford to. But then I left school and I got a job and then went off to university and then had a bit more money to sort of spend on drinking and things. And I got into a real turning point for me was that I got into a relationship with someone who I was with from 19 to 22, and that just turned really toxic. We were both big drinkers. He had his own things that he was working through, and together we were just an awful combination. And I was so desperate for his approval, and he was older than me. He was 7 years older. So he had very set ways that he thought things should be done, and he wanted things to be done. And it was quite a controlling environment, but I was fine with that because I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I wanted to be or who I was comfortable with. So I just let him tell me. And I just completely lost myself in what I thought he wanted of me in our relationship. And, that went on for a while, and we drank heavily together, and sometimes we would get into horrific fights when we were drunk. And I'm not a victim of domestic abuse, but there was mutual, like, physical fighting. And we'd wake up and there'd be blood on the pillows, and you wouldn't really remember what you'd done the night before or what you'd argued about. And it was just this horrible, toxic environment. And he left me just after my 22nd birthday, and I had sort of pictured this life of us together. I was going to marry him. We were going to have kids and 4 kids and 2 dogs and a house out of London. And that was all I'd been working towards, all I'd been thinking about. And I just felt so lost. I felt like someone had just pulled that rug out from under me.
That must have been a really incredibly difficult breakup for you to handle, because it sounds like the relationship was very codependent, and he was part of your identity, and for that just to be shattered, all those dreams must have been so hard for you to cope emotionally.
Yeah. I stayed in bed for like 6 weeks. I just didn't function. I didn't tell my friends at first because I hoped he would change his mind and I wouldn't have to. And it's as we sort of slowly sort of realized, no, that's it, we're done. I was just crushed, and I sort of, in without him telling me who I was going to be, what I was going to be, I had to make decisions for myself. And I decided, well, I'm just going to be a party girl then. I'm just going to go out. I'm going to accept every invitation. And I got a job working in events in the city. So I was around really wealthy people, you know, bankers and high flyers and people with huge budgets.
It's a great distraction for a breakup if you're all of a sudden in this very fast-paced environment that's very exciting, and you don't really have to think about how much pain you're in if you've got a whole new lifestyle to be focusing on.
Yeah, you don't have to think about the pain you're in when you're drinking, when you've got all of these bright lights and people, and I just got so swept up in it, and I was still healing. I was still in quite a lot of pain from that relationship, And what I needed was time for introspection, time to get myself really well and work those things out. But what I did instead was just numb it out. And being in this sort of wealthy crowd, it wasn't long before people started offering me cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I just took it because I was going out five nights a week, six nights a week. And to do that, just drinking until the early hours, is really hard. But cocaine would sort of prop me up and keep me going. And it meant that I could stay out longer or later or drink more alcohol. And it meant the hangover wasn't a hangover. It was a come down, which was slightly different. And I could pace it and manage it differently. Mm-hmm. And it felt like the second layer of my solution. Like I'd found the alcohol as a kid and now I could upgrade it and supplement it with something else to make it more sustainable for me.
Yeah. Can you explain the personality changes that you would notice, particularly in the early days of taking cocaine? What would you notice after you did a line of cocaine? How would your personality change?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. So I would usually already have been drinking before I started, you know, taking cocaine for the night. And I can just remember just this sort of lifting up, like suddenly this sense of being completely indestructible, the sort of no fear of what you're talking about or who you're talking to, and actually no ability to track those things. So you could quite often be saying the same thing to people over again, or I have had full conversations twice with people without any realization that I was doing that. And I think the thing with cocaine, the thing that I really felt most was that when I was taking cocaine, nothing satisfied me. I could not drink enough. I couldn't smoke enough. I couldn't be out late enough. I couldn't dance enough. There was no end point. It was like a series of itches I could never properly scratch. You know, it just meant that I just wanted everything to continue for as long as I could possibly squeeze it out. And that meant I got really panicky when other people would say, oh no, I'm done, I'm going to go home now. Because I just couldn't face the idea of stopping. Because as soon as I stopped, as soon as I put down the coke or started to come round, I would just be faced with the realization of what I'd done. I'd have to face how I was feeling and the mess I'd made and the mess in my flat and the things I'd said to my friends or my colleagues or my boss or the person I'd hooked up with who I hated myself for hooking up with, you know. So what's better than that in my mind is just don't let it run out. Don't stop drinking. Don't stop taking drugs. Don't stop smoking until you just pass out, you know.
Yeah, it's very scary to be confronted with all the emotional impact of that cycle. I'm curious about empathy, compassion, kindness, and really positive feelings for other people while you have done cocaine. So, and just comparing to like how you are now and like, you know, just feeling very positive about human connection. Can you reflect back on like just empathy and what happened to empathy for you when you were doing cocaine?
Specifically when I was on coke, like when I was actually high, I probably didn't think much about other people. It's very much my own motives. You know, someone's got to go because they've got an important meeting in the morning that they need to get up for. I just wouldn't have cared. If that wasn't in line with what I wanted. But overall, in that sort of period of time when I was taking drugs, the problem was that my mood would be on such waves. You know, I'd either be high, high thinking of myself or low, low thinking of myself. There was no plateau. I was either on a come down or high or drunk or hungover. And there's just no capacity to stop and think like what's going on in someone else's life. And I, you know, I have friends who I had during that time, the girls I lived with at university and some of my friends from school who I maintained those friendships with. But it's fair to say that I am a far better, more present, more empathetic friend now, because I just didn't have capacity to notice when people needed me. I was so one track focused.
Yeah. How many years were you doing cocaine for?
So actually only 3 years in total. I got sober when I was 25, and I started taking cocaine when I broke up with that boyfriend at 22. But for me, it was quite a fast spiral. I think the first time I took it, I remember lying there and it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and obviously I'd started the night before. So I went hard straight away. I didn't just try a little bit on my, you know, whatever, like dab a little bit. I went straight in. And I lying there and I was getting my heart was pounding. And I thought, actually, you haven't enjoyed this. Like, tick it off. You've tried it. It's something, you know, you've done. Everyone has to experiment, but you're done now. But then a week later, someone offered me it again. And I thought, yeah, go on then. And I remember the third time I took it thinking, you don't want to take this, but you've still chosen to take it. Is that a problem? But I did it anyway, because I didn't feel like there was any reason not to.
What was your rock bottom? Because it's very interesting that at 25 and, you know, 3 years went by. For a lot of people, it's much longer before they make that decision. What was it for you where you were able to make that decision that you wanted to change in your life?
Yeah, I think the age that I got sober is something that I am most grateful for, because if it was a choice of continuing to live those 3 years indefinitely, I think I'd rather die. It's such a desperate, horrific place when you're battling yourself constantly to try and tell yourself you don't want to do something that you just keep going back to, and you feel this shame and guilt, and you can see the judgment of other people around you, and people just don't understand why you keep doing it. And there's, you know, with the best logic in the world, you just cannot will yourself away from it. And that is exhausting and debilitating and depressing. And so the fact that I stopped when I did, I think is the biggest gift. So yeah, you're right though. 3 years is a short amount of time. And compared to the vast majority of stories that you hear, that I hear,
it is a really long amount of time. But I hear a lot of cocaine stories.
You are living it.
Yeah. I think it is amazing that at 25 you were able to do that for yourself. And it's so nice to hear that you have so much gratitude for something happened to help you get out of it. Was there a rock bottom moment, or was there some kind of moments that you remember just beforehand that helped you try to break that cycle?
Yeah, definitely. And I was probably a year in when I first said to myself, stop now, and couldn't, and continue to say like, okay, but tonight you're not going to, and then would be sort of trapped in that battle. And there were a few things that were just downright dangerous. Positions I'd put myself in, getting into cars with strangers, going to clubs on my own, making conversation with people who I didn't know just so because I knew they had drugs on them. It's like a radar. I can tell when someone's got cocaine on them, and I just make a beeline for them to see if I can get some if I've run out. And just ending up in some dodgy places with dodgy people. And thinking like, this really could have gone wrong. And sometimes it didn't go well. You know, thankfully I'm alive and I'm here. So
I think it's so interesting that you're saying like you just had that kind of intuitionist, you knew who had the cocaine, and you kind of had this like magic radar that just picked up on it. And I've definitely seen people have that and be able to kind of just instinctively know who's got the cocaine and make friends with that person, so that it's already very easy for people to get cocaine. But if people are finding themselves that they're in an addictive cycle, they actually become masters at knowing, and that actually people who've taken cocaine do act different, and there is this kind of air of arrogance. And if you see someone in a room who's acting like that, then if someone is looking out for cocaine, it's quite easy to figure out who the people are who have it. You know, and that's it's such a dangerous thing that it's so easy for people to
everyone's get bodies move differently when they've taken cocaine in very small ways. So some people will move their jaw differently, some people purse their lips, some people flex their hands and don't realize they're doing it. And then also just the way they're communicating, if they're going to the toilet a lot, things like that. You just You just know.
Yeah. And if you're craving it, you know, because you're like hyper focused, you're like a sniper looking out for these behaviors, these tiny little mannerisms in people that give the game away. So you became an expert at that, which meant that you could access it very easily, probably without having to pay for it on many occasions.
Yeah. Yeah. And then and that continued, and I was taking more and more, and I got into a state where I wasn't washing properly. I didn't open my mail. I didn't wash my clothes. I got numbness in my fingers and toes, and these sort of floaters in front of my eyes and nosebleeds. And I got a twitch that would go off on where my lip would start sort of flecking up and down when I drank too much. You know, and the whole point of the drugs and alcohol was to facilitate my socializing, but I was just plummeting. You know, I wasn't the sort of person you wanted to sit next to on the bus. It was it was difficult. I'd say there's probably a few moments that I see as rock bottoms.
Can I just ask how often were you taking it? So when you were in your worst moments, how frequently was it?
Probably four nights a week would have been normal, and then three nights here and there to recover, but almost certainly Friday and Saturday night, usually Thursday as well, and then maybe once during the week. But I would say I was drinking daily as well.
Yeah. And were you taking cocaine at home, or was that always a social thing?
It would usually be a social thing, but if I was dating someone, I would take cocaine at home with them as well.
Yeah.
And if I had any left from a night out, which I inevitably would, because I would pick up such big quantities, because I had this fear of it running out. So yeah. I would take it back home and sit up on my own and use until it was done. So often until, you know, if I'd come home at 2 a.m., I'd still be sitting at my dining table at 7 a.m.
On your own, taking it.
Yeah.
That must have been such lonely times when you were taking it on your own. So you said there was a couple of different rock bottoms that you hit.
There are a few things that stand out when people talk about rock bottoms, but you know, it's something people say all the time, is that every rock bottom's got a trap door. And I definitely believe that I carried on pushing things past probably both of these experiences, but they were the tipping points. And so the first was, I had been out in a restaurant with some of my friends who didn't take any drugs, and we'd had a few glasses of wine, and I decided I was going to pick up, because I thought we were going to a club afterwards. It was a Thursday night out in Shoreditch, and I went and picked up 2 grams of cocaine, so well enough to last me for that night. Got back to the restaurant where we were sort of having coffees or whatever, and they said, oh, do you know what, we've been thinking about it, and it's already 10 o'clock, so we're gonna call it a night, we don't need to go out. And I thought, well, got these drugs now, so I'm obviously going to take them. So I went home and I called my ex-boyfriend, who I'd just broken up with, got him to come over from Horsham to London. So he had to get an hour's taxi or something ridiculous. And we sat up together and took these 2 grams of cocaine, and then I went to bed having just done a line of coke at 7:30 in the morning, when my phone went off to tell me to get up to go to work. And I just text my boss and said, I'm high, I'm not coming in. And she said, okay, you know, sleep this off, and we're going to talk at the end of the day. And I think she realized that I was unwell, rather than just sort of, you know, skiving. So she was very good about it. But then I called my sister and asked my sister to come over, who I hadn't spoken to about any drug use or anything. And I asked her to come over, and I just said, I need help. I just need help. I need you to help me. I can't stop doing this. And she was great. She moved me out of my flat and moved me in with her, and she typed up a resignation letter, sent me into work on Monday with a pre-typed resignation letter. So I'd say that was a big change for me. And
such a huge thing to ask your sister for help. I mean, that was such a brave move, and she knew nothing about this. So for you to have to confess everything, but also to say that you needed help, is quite a big thing.
Yeah, I think having worked with a lot of people in recovery now, been in a lot of those groups and in that environment, when you hear someone say, help me, it is the most powerful thing that I've heard. It just shifts. It shifts the room. It shifts the way people respond to them, but it shifts the way they relate to themselves, because they realize that they're not alone.
And it's you being so vulnerable, because when people take cocaine, they're not vulnerable. They're like this bravado and this the kind of arrogance and the way, and the, you know, this fake confidence comes out, and it's, you know, none of that is very attractive at all. But you just don't see a vulnerable person. It's very hard to empathize with a cocaine user who's acting in those kind of ways. But actually, when someone says, help me, it's really actually very easy to empathize with someone who's in that position, who's being so vulnerable and asking for a loved one to help them out of that situation.
Yeah, and she did, and she was such a great support. And I she asked me what I was going to do next, and was quite sort of set that she didn't think going into sort of hospitality and events and things was a good idea for me, given that it was quite a sort of toxic environment at times. So I actually, the dinner that I'd had in Shoreditch had been with one of my friends who had moved to Paris after university, and we were in a French restaurant, and she translated part of the menu for me, and I thought, that is so cool. So in my broken state, where I knew I needed a new life, I decided I was going to have hers. So I decided to move to Paris, and I'd never been to Paris before as an adult. I'd been to Disneyland as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I went and I moved to the north of Paris, and I already had a bit of a friendship group set up there through her and some other people from university, and that was amazing. And but I was there for about 9 months, still drinking, and I didn't have drugs there because I didn't really speak French. I wouldn't have known where to get them or how to go about that at that point. But I drank really heavily and spent a lot of the time just sort of with blackout blinds down in bed, hungover, or going out, and definitely got a reputation amongst my French friends and the people who live there, because people don't binge drink in the same way. The culture is very different. They enjoy wine and they enjoy drinks with dinner, but to get really drunk, to throw up, to make a show of yourself is very countercultural for them.
Yeah.
And I really see that.
It's very interesting, because you put yourself in a situation where you knew that you couldn't access drugs, but drink was still very accessible. But it's just fascinating that if you take someone out of their culture where it's totally acceptable to get blackout drunk, and then you put them into a different culture where it's frowned upon, it must have been very interesting for you to see some different reactions and some disapprovals that you may not have seen in the UK so much.
It was embarrassing. I felt far more embarrassed by my behavior in France than I did in the UK. And I don't think I've actually said that before, but that's definitely the case.
I'm interested in the sexual side of things, because you mentioned a few times like hooking up with people was something that you did very easily on cocaine, and was so ashamed about those decisions when you were sober. Could you just tell me about like your decision making when you were on cocaine, when it came to hooking up with someone, and what kind of behaviors did you end up doing that were just so out of character for you?
Yeah, I think if it weren't for drugs and alcohol, I probably would only have had any kind of sexual encounter within a relationship, because I know myself now, and I know that that's what's really important to me, is that physical intimacy matches emotional intimacy, and that's when it feels good and that's when it's exciting. Yeah. But actually, in those states, like, you feel so lonely that sometimes it doesn't feel like such a big deal to hook up with someone, or to, you know, just even just to flirt with someone or something like that. Like, there's a sort of need for attention, and that's a very specific type of attention that gives quite a short-term buzz, like a short-term fix. And I think it does go hand in hand with cocaine use. I think it is a difficult, and you're just not making sensible decisions when you're high and drunk. You're just not representing yourself well, you know?
Yeah. And did you find that it was very impulsive?
Yeah, I think so. I think definitely everything when you're taking cocaine is impulsive. It's never, you know, when you're high or drunk, you don't take the time to think like, I'm going to reflect on this for a day or two and then make that decision. You just go for it, you know, and you just go with whatever feels like it's going to give you the biggest buzz in that moment. And that applies sort of across the board. Even gambling, I gambled a lot more when I was when I was drinking and high. But also I think that what was important to me, that something I didn't have in its right place at the time, was my image. And obviously I looked like a total wreck, whatever, but in my head there were certain drinks I should be drinking, certain, you know, going to a casino was great and that made me look great. It doesn't at all. It's really grotty. I mean, unless you're spending like huge amounts of money. Casinos are not fabulous, extravagant places. They're like lots of slot machines and you know, you stick to the carpet. But that's it. Those kind of things all sort of played into this like really destructive lifestyle, just where I wasn't thinking through the emotional effect or financial effect that those decisions would have on me.
Yeah. So you were in Paris and you're still drinking heavily, and that was, you were picking up on this kind of sort of disapproval about that. So what happened next for you?
I started seeing someone in Paris who was a waiter, and he would finish work at about midnight. And he worked at a restaurant just around the corner from where I lived. So I could go out with my friends, have a normal night, and not have to push them to stay out later with me, because I knew he would finish at midnight. So I could leave them at 11:30, 12 o'clock, go and see him. And he started to bring me cocaine. And that was sort of a tipping point, I think, particularly for my friends, because it's one thing moving country to avoid drugs, but still drinking a lot. But they just couldn't get on board with the idea that I would now be taking cocaine in Paris. Mm-hmm. And he was a bit of a dodgy character. And I think that they were quite concerned about our relationship as well. So in the end, there was one night where I had gone for one drink with a friend from university who was actually my flatmate at the time. And I had promised her it was going to be one drink. But when she got up to leave, I said, oh, well, I'm just going to call him and see if he's free to come and join me then, because I don't want to stop. And she was a bit annoyed, but she thought, fine, you can do what you want to do. And then that night just escalated and ended up in me completely blacking out. And she came storming into my room the following morning, and the two of us were there, and she sort of slammed open the door, and she was so angry with me because I'd been so loud and we'd had a big argument in the flat that I couldn't remember the night before. And I had a black eye and I don't know where I got it from. I don't know if he hit me or if I got into a fight in the street or if he got into a fight and I got in the middle of it. I just don't know. And she was just so disappointed in me. She was fuming. And she said, you know, I'd missed a train. I was supposed to be getting a train that morning that I'd missed. And she just said, look, something's got to give. You know, we cannot keep supporting you where you keep making these same mistakes. I want you to go and find a support group for people who are struggling with drug addiction. I want you to try that.
Mm. She sounds like a really caring friend.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah. You know, that like it was like tough love, but like I just sensed so much love in that. Like she was saying the right thing. She wasn't trying to make you feel bad or anything. She was just really worried about you.
Yeah, she was. And actually, I think a huge thing that has been really pivotal for my recovery has been the relationships that I had in place with people like that, with people like that friend and a few other friends from within that group and my family as well, is just the unrelenting support that I've had from them and the recognition that this is tough and it's going to take a long time, but they're not going anywhere. And she's definitely one of those people. And I'm really grateful for that, because I wonder where I'd be or if I'd be alive if I hadn't had those positive influences.
A lot of people don't have that support, so that was another blessing for you, and possibly the reason you managed to break out of it so young was you had really caring people around you that loved you, who said you can't continue doing this, and even though you perhaps didn't feel strong enough to break out of it on your own, that actually that support maybe gave you that strength that you needed. So was that sort of what happened after that night? Was that the final straw, or did it take longer before you started to before things started to change?
Yeah, that was the final straw, but it still took me about 3 weeks to actually turn up at one of those meetings. And they handed it to me on a plate. They had Googled it. It was a bilingual French-English meeting, so I could go even if my French wasn't very good and everything like that. but it took me a while to actually get myself through the door, and I had a lot of excuses and things, but I did go, and that was on the 22nd of April 2014. And I can picture myself walking down there just thinking, what am I doing? Why am I going to this? You know, and I got in the building and I couldn't work out which room it was. So I had to ask the woman behind the reception desk which room it was. And I was so embarrassed that she then knew that I was there for this meeting. And I went.
Did you feel you'd be different to the other people in the room? Like, was it like a, I don't belong in this meeting?
It's interesting because my experience of drug recovery meetings since has been that they're often male. Predominantly male, and often quite a bit older than me. Like if you look around the room, you're often with sort of 40 to 50s males, whereas in alcohol groups it's more 50-50, big age range and stuff like that. But drugs can be quite specific in that. But this time I turned up and there was one bloke there and six women, and they were all roughly my age. And five of them had about 3 months sober-ish, 3 to 6 months each. So they were just out of reach from where I was. Yeah. And then the other one was about 4 years. And
Very interesting group, because that's actually not the age range that you would we'd see in these groups. So you must have got lucky with that one.
So lucky, honestly. And they were just amazing. And I think I went expecting to go once, you know, find it interesting, but not really bother going back. But it changed my life. They just had this outlook on life that I wasn't expecting. And they talked in a way that felt so fulfilled and so wholesome. And I just hadn't experienced anything like that in a long time. I hadn't been around it. I hadn't felt like it was accessible to me. And it just felt like they, what was magic about it was that there were things that they knew about me that I didn't even need to say. You know, they knew the desperation, they knew the struggle, they knew the battle that went on in my head. They knew that I hated it when I heard the sound of the birds in the morning, because that was just a signal that I had stayed up and messed up again. And I didn't need to tell them that. They had all of that information, and it was honestly like magic talking to them, because I just thought I was alone until I heard them speak. And I just cried. I just sat there and cried and said, like, you know, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know what life looks like without drugs and alcohol, and I don't know if I want it anyway, you know. And they were just so gentle and so encouraging. It was amazing.
What was 12 steps like for you? Because different people, you know, do different things. 12 steps is a very, very common approach. So tell me about your experience of 12 steps and just what parts of it particularly worked for you.
So I've worked the steps a few times now, and I'm a big advocate for them, but I do think that it's okay if people don't use them. I've got lots of friends in recovery who haven't used the 12 steps, who've used other means and therapies and groups. And I definitely initially felt like everyone should do this. And I feel increasingly more like you need to work out what's right for you. But what worked for me was 12-step recovery. And I'm really grateful for it. And I had an amazing sponsor who sort of talked me through it. And so steps 1 to 3, where you identify the madness that's going on with you, and you are completely open and honest, and you let go of any denial about your drinking behaviors and your addictive behaviors. That was really tough. In the 12 steps, they talk about a higher power. That was actually fine for me, and that is a stumbling block for a lot of people. But I started going to a church, so I felt like that was in line with a lot of the stuff that I was already invested in. So that sat okay with me.
I just want to pick up on the honesty thing, as you said, like step 1, 2, 3. That must have been that must have felt like such a relief or a weight off your chest, because often if people are kind of sucked into addiction, there's a lot of lying has to happen just to be able to sustain that lifestyle. Did you feel like a weight was lifted after you started practicing this honesty in your life?
Definitely, yes. It felt good to be able to express things in a safe environment, obviously not sort of banding about your life secrets to the whole world, but with a sponsor or with a close friend, just to be able to speak more truth, because there is so much lies, there's so much manipulation, so much hiding, so much sort of keeping yourself away so people don't realize what's really going on. So that was a breath of fresh air. I think that weight lifted off for me though when I did the steps coming after is 4 and 5, which is where you write a moral inventory and you list any fears you have, anything that you're resentful towards, any time you've harmed another person, and every sexual encounter that you've had. And you say those things out loud to another person, which is terrifying. But I always thought that if someone really knew me, the things I'd done, the things I'd thought, the things I'd said, they'd run a mile. That they would not accept me, that they wouldn't, that they wouldn't want anything to do with me, that I was completely unlovable in my truest form.
You must have felt so bad about yourself when you were keeping all of that stuff in.
Totally. And then saying it to someone else and have them go, at the times, go, yeah, me too, or yeah, I know, because she was in recovery herself, my sponsor. But also just to have someone go like, that's okay. Like, yeah, that wasn't a good decision. That's okay. I'm still going to be here next week. I'm still going to take your phone call. I still love you. I still care about you.
That really was a shame.
Yeah. It was transformational. It pierced all of that. I couldn't continue telling myself the story that no one wanted me around, that if people only knew how bad I was, they would run a mile, because actually people started sticking around, and I think people liked me more for the honesty I was bringing.
Yeah, that's really beautiful, just to start practicing that very extreme but very different way of living your life and realizing, oh, actually people like me more when I'm like completely myself, and like, you know, and you had these shocking secrets to tell that you assumed was going to lead naturally to rejection, and actually people gravitated towards you rather than ran away. I want to ask about your sponsor. Was that someone, so how does that work? Is that someone you can contact at any point? What's that kind of relationship like?
Yeah, if you get a good sponsor, that's life-changing. And I, again, just cannot believe how much I fell on my feet in my early recovery days that I met her. She had gotten sober very young, far younger than me as well. And that was really important to me, because I still felt like I was in my partying prime and I'd had alcohol taken away from me. And that was something that we shared. So by the time she sponsored me, she was 16 years sober. Now she'd be well into the 20s. And she just had so much wisdom. And I heard her speak at a recovery meeting. I think it was on my 9th day in recovery or something like that. It was very early on. And someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, if you're looking for a sponsor, that woman is incredible. And I thought, I'm not going to let this. I'm not going to let this slip. So I actually not chased her, or maybe followed her to the metro station and sort of waited for her friend to leave her, and then tapped on the shoulder and said, hi, I was in the meeting. I was sitting behind you. Would you be able to sponsor me? And she said yes. And I cannot believe how much time she gave me without sending me a bill, without ever asking for anything back from me.
I think it's amazing that you had the courage to approach her, because that like feels really awkward. And because she was speaking, you know, it's like all eyes were on her. Perhaps she's got lots of other people who are asking for the same favor. So you must be nervous when you were approaching her.
And part of asking someone to sponsor you as well is being open to the idea that they may not have time or capacity, and that's not about you, and that there may be an element of rejection. And that's tough. And I've been rejected by people since, because I've asked other people to sponsor me when I moved back to the UK so I could have someone in this country and stuff. And that is hard, but it is also part of the process. And
yes, that's have to look after themselves in that you can't sponsor everyone. So therefore, like if you sponsor like one or two people, you can do an amazing job. But if you sponsor 10 people, you're probably going to let lots of people down. So it must be a difficult thing.
Yeah, and the time commitment's phenomenal. I sponsor a few women at the moment, and for some that is a daily phone call and meeting up every week. And yeah. Whereas there are others who it's just a phone call every week or twice a week, so it's far less time. But you don't want to commit to doing that unless you're sure that you can give them your best.
As well, because when people go to therapists, if that therapist has not been through a struggle that's been incredibly similar, it can often be very hard to empathize to a level that is what the person needs. And also your therapy bill is going to be just outrageous if you have to like keep calling your therapist out, you know, like on a Friday night, it's like 2 a.m. Your therapist is not going to answer the phone. And, you know, and if you end up finding a therapist who will, that therapy bill is just going to be out of control. So I think I really think having a peer who could understand you in that way, and also for you to not fear judgment, because the other thing about going to a therapist is that there is a fear of judgment, particularly if you think your therapist can't relate to like this crazy lifestyle and stuff. And also if they can relate, it's unprofessional for a therapist to go, yeah, I can completely relate because I did all those things, or I had situations in my life, and they can't really self-disclose, whereas actually your peer completely can. So it's a very different type of relationship. So did that help you when you had temptation to go back to that lifestyle?
Yeah, definitely. And we had a system in place, particularly early doors, where if I was going somewhere where there would be heavy drinking or even potentially drugs, and I made a real point of particularly avoiding situations with drugs. I think it's hard to completely avoid alcohol because, you know, dinner, restaurants, bars, if you want to socialize as a 25-year-old, you know, alcohol. But I could, you know, my friends were not into drugs. It was me who was into drugs. So my friends in Paris weren't at all. So avoiding drugs was pretty simple. But but if I felt I was going into a sort of danger zone, I would call her before and afterwards. And knowing that I was going to do that was great. And I could also nip into the toilets. And I would, as I went to more recovery meetings, I made friends with more people in those groups so I could phone them as well. And that network was just invaluable, just to check in and say, like, I'm thinking about drinking. Can you just stay on the phone with me for 5 minutes? And everyone gets that. And everyone's got time for that because they know how important that is.
That's amazing. I want to ask about the God thing. So like for some people who join AA, they, or sorry, 12 steps, they don't like the word God because maybe they're agnostic or maybe they're spiritual. So they perhaps do believe in the higher power, but they don't want to use the word God because that doesn't really fit for them. So what do you think about that? If someone is like, no, I hate 12 steps, I can't do that because of this God thing.
Yeah, it happens a lot. I get a lot of people saying that they wouldn't consider doing the 12 steps because it feels too Christian, or it feels too like a sort of church thing, or it feels like they're just going to get God rammed down their throat. Like there are programs for people who don't feel comfortable with that. Like Smart Recovery is a similar sort of structured program without. And I think it is a case of finding what's right for you. What's important is that you get clean and sober. And if one tool doesn't sit for you, then that's fine. But if you are able to put the sort of, because a lot of people have been hurt by religion as well, and it can feel very painful to come into what feels like a religious setting. But if you are able to sort of park that, there are people who I know who will just think of a higher power being the fact that a group of people together has more strength, has more power than one person on their own. And that's undeniable. You know, a group of people in a room with a common purpose will be able to achieve more together than if you go out there on your own. And if it works for you, that's your higher power, then absolutely go for it, you know?
Yeah. So people can just replace the word God with something that fits for them. So they can just, you know, say perhaps higher power
or strength of the collective group or whatever. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And did you meet people like that who were like, well, I'm not into that, but I've reframed it in my mind where actually all the steps do make sense for me because I've slightly changed the meaning, so it works better for me.
Yeah, there are definitely, people really do take the sort of God as you understand him quite literally, and people understand God or a deity or a higher power in so many different ways. I think it's quite common for people to have have just spent some time reflecting on what that is for them.
Mm-hmm. Got it. What about relapses?
So actually, from that day, and this is again where my story differs from the vast majority. So from that day that I went to that meeting, I haven't drunk or taken drugs.
Wow.
Yeah. So in the time that I was using, I made lots of sort of pledges to myself, which I didn't hold up. But I think I would struggle to use the word relapse for that, because I don't know how committed I was to each of those sort of mini promises that I just ignored when the night came. Yeah. But no, I haven't had a sort of within the 12-step program relapse as things stand. Obviously we take each day as it comes, and I'm not immune to anything. Yeah. But at the moment I feel really strong in that.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. Well done.
Thank you.
How long has it been?
So 6 years, sorry. 6 years and 2 months.
Oh my gosh, that is such an achievement. I think you say that, like, you had these supportive friends, sensible, they weren't into drugs. So that's like kind of like makes the departing from drugs a bit easier. But the alcohol, was that more challenging just because of the society we live in?
Yeah. Yeah, you're like I said, you can't escape alcohol. You're faced with it everywhere. So it is really difficult to be around it. And I remember the first time someone had an alcoholic drink in front of me, and it was an afternoon, so not a big sort of evening thing. And my friends had taken me bowling because we were trying to find sort of low-key fun activities to do together. And afterwards we went to a little sort of bistro on the corner, and we were sitting outside, and the woman came over and said, "Oh, it's happy hour, do you want cocktails?" And I ordered like a lemonade or something, and my friend said, "Actually, I will have a cocktail, yes." And she got this cocktail, and I thought, and it was a safe environment. I was with people I knew really well. And I remember just feeling like it was watching me from the table, just so aware that that alcoholic drink was there. But that feeling, it went, and it went quite quickly as well. You know, as I got more comfortable with my sobriety, I'm far less aware of people drinking around me. I don't really like it if someone comes and offers me like a tray of drinks, but you know, if you're at a party or something, but there's not a huge amount, I just say no. And
yeah, have you had interesting statements from people like, "Oh, but surely you can just have one drink and just not go back to the drugs," or like anything like that? That what kind of things do people say to you on a, you know, from time to time basis?
Yeah, because I haven't relapsed, a few people have said, "I wonder if you actually had a problem. You know, do you think maybe you didn't have a problem?" Or, you know, "Your self-will now will be so much stronger, so you could probably drink." Or, you know, "Oh, but you never say never, you know, you could." Or a few people thought that, like, you know, I wouldn't be drinking, but I could still like try their drink or have a sip here and there and stuff like that. I find it hard to find that stuff annoying, because I think people just don't understand, and that's fine, because and if it feels right and it's in the right setting, then I'll sort of say to them and explain a little bit more the thinking behind it. But yeah, I can understand that mentality. And I know for me, before this was a personal issue for me, when I was quite a lot younger, I just thought if someone was an addict, they were just weak. Like, what do you mean? You know, I remember someone saying to me, "If you're," and this makes so much sense, but so little sense, "If you're addicted to cocaine, why don't you just stop taking it?" And it's like, okay, I see your logic, but there's no logic to that.
Yeah. Just like, I mean, if you were a robot, then that would be easy. But, you know, you're human, you've got emotions, so it becomes a lot more complex. Sometimes when people are in the early stages of trying to figure out what to do, they will be very unsure as to whether sobriety is the right thing, or whether, you know, whether they just give up drugs, you know, or maybe just give up alcohol for a certain period of time to try and regain control. And there's a whole, like, they just don't know the answers. For you, how did you make the decision to become completely sober? And was there a lot of to and froing? Did you question that before you finally decided?
My intention was to give up drugs, not alcohol. I, for a long time, didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. And it was only working with my sponsor and looking at my past behavior as part of that sort of step one that we talked about, when I realized actually alcohol was a really big deal for me. So in that first meeting, I asked the question, we all went for lunch afterwards, and I asked the question, does anybody here, has everybody here given up alcohol? And everyone except for one person said yes. So there was one person there who was giving up drugs, but not alcohol. Mm-hmm. And she was 3 days sober, and everyone else was 3 months, 6 months, a couple of years sober. And mm-hmm. for me, that sort of clinched it. It was actually, if I want to do this, it's going to have to be all or nothing. And yeah. the thing that actually swung it was I called my sister after the meeting because I told her I was going. And I said, you know, it's a meeting for people who struggle with cocaine, but they say I shouldn't drink. They say I shouldn't have any mind altering substance. And she did not take a breath. She just said, do it.
Yeah. Do it.
And it was that conviction. And actually, if anyone in that meeting had given me any shade of grey, if they'd said to me, you can probably give up cocaine and still drink, or you could probably drink, you know, two nights a week and be fine, I would have tried. Mm-hmm. And I would have carried on trying for months before I had that realization. I need people to say, no, this is what works for us, and this is what we believe will work for you. I do think, you know, it's hard to say that one size fits all. And if people feel that they can moderate their drinking, then provided a doctor hasn't told them, no, you're about to die, your liver's packing up, then try, you know, try. But actually, if you've been trying, or you've set yourself those boundaries and you're not hitting them, then it's probably time to ask bigger questions and to ask yourself if the only way that you're going to be fully free of addiction is through abstinence. And for me, that is definitely the case.
It sounds like what you're telling me is there's such a strong correlation between people giving up drinking and being able to stay sober from drugs. And also, you had 3 years of this crazy lifestyle, and addiction was really had really taken hold of you. And now you got sober relatively young. You gave up the alcohol as well, and you've had 6 years sober. I think it's very, very helpful for people to hear that information. What advice would you give them at this point? So let's just say they've kind of found themselves in lots of chaotic situations. They have maybe had friends tell them it's problematic, and they're kind of maybe at that pre-contemplation phase of change.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what I would say is that what you're experiencing is, it's not just you that's experienced that. You know, this is a really difficult and painful thing, but it feels so isolated. And actually, there are so many people who understand the pain and the upset and the desperation of it, and you should never feel alone. And the best thing that you could do is reach out and hear some of those stories and just work out, you know, if that is in line with what you're going through, you know. And I think, as you know, as we started off saying, asking for help is so powerful. There's nothing wrong with saying, like, will you help me? I don't know a single person who's achieved solid sobriety and recovery who did it on their own, locked in a room. It's all with the help of groups and friends and other people in sobriety and family members and therapists and whatever's worked for them, and watching videos online and reading books and connecting and realizing that actually their life is far more valuable and that they are far greater than the sum of their negative experiences. And actually what they can experience outside of that addiction is so incredible. It's something that will be better than the best thing they've imagined within that space. It is worth fighting for. And if they can get themselves to a point where they can reach out, they may start to unpick that and start to realize, like, what actually is waiting for them if they put in this work.
Could you just tell me a little bit about the difference in relation to how you were connecting with people when you were really struggling, and how you feel connected to people now?
Yeah, so when I was struggling, my connection with people was about what they could do for me. It was self-serving. It was who they could introduce me to, how long they could party with me, how long they'd put up with my behavior. It was what could I drag them to, or how much would they drink with me, and if they made me feel good, you know, if being around them made me laugh, if I could serve myself in some way.
So self-centered. And then when someone is in that mode, how can they connect with others? Because others are just going to be a bit repelled, and you know, and they're just going to be like, I'm not connecting with this person at all. they're really not into people. They're into, you know, what can they do? What can people do for me? Rather than actually, how can we mutually connect and form a strong bond?
Yeah. What's so sad about that as well is it's that thing that they say about kids at school is that the bullies are often the people in the most pain, you know, and it's like those, and that this is kind of the adult version, like of someone pushing you over in the playground, like, yeah, they just want what they can get from you, but they just don't realize the value of deeply connecting with you. And they don't have the facilities and the capacity and the ability to do that. They don't realize how to do that or what you would both gain from that. And that's really hard. These days, my friendships are mutual, and you know, it's not parasitic anymore. Like, I love spending time with my friends and chatting to them, but it's about how we can lift each other up, how we can encourage each other, how we can speak the best into each other's lives and offer a pick-me-up or just a kind word. Or, you know, during all of this lockdown, like, someone might send you a little chocolate bar and a card or something, and it's just, you know, it's about being as present and hearing that person and really listening to them and engaging with them in a way that I was never interested in doing before. Yeah.
That must feel so different for you.
It's totally different, but so, so incredible, because I don't feel afraid. I don't feel afraid that my friends are about to leave. They're not only there because they think I'm fun or bring drugs or dance on tables. They're there because they value me for who I am. You know, even if I'm not having an on day or I'm going through something that's difficult to talk about, they're not going anywhere because their interest in me is not purely for excitement. They're there because they care about who I really am. You know, and that's such stable ground to be on compared to where I was before.